Welcome. My name is Steve Gortmaker, and this is the Modeling Cost Effectiveness of Childhood Obesity Interventions and Policies session. Quickly read through that. Good. Yeah, people who are walking in, I mean, you don't care that I'm walking through this stuff, do you? No. Can the folks in the back hear me? Okay, great. I'm going to make a few comments about why cost effectiveness. I'm going to overview the methods that have been used across these studies, or these four studies that you're going to hear about today. It's part of a larger process project. I'm then going to turn it over to my colleagues who are going to present the four cost effectiveness evaluations. Then I'll come back and talk a little bit about a comparison across the interventions, and then we'll have some commentaries from Claire Wong and Bill Dietz. And then you get to speak. So I'm going to ask you, we've set aside time for questions. I'm going to ask you not to ask questions during the different sessions, but write down those questions, and we have a chunk of time for you to ask your questions and get some conversation going. Why cost effectiveness? My experience has been that when you talk to decision makers about your work, you know, what can you do to improve childhood obesity, they want to know three things. What's feasible, you know, the intervention, the program, the policy, how effective is it, and what will it cost? So that's why. That's why cost effectiveness. We like to think of something called the cost effectiveness plane. The one thing we don't want to do is do really expensive things with bad outcomes or worse outcomes. The poster child up in this corner would be like the U.S. healthcare system relative to the rest of the world. What we really like to do would be like to have lower cost and better outcomes. And that's what we're going to try and identify for you today. We clearly can't afford to do all the childhood obesity interventions we'd like to implement, so why not begin with those producing the biggest bang for the buck? That's the simple idea here. Of course, it gets much more complicated in the end. Feel free to come up front. There are some really great seats here, you know, and we're just talking about a little background stuff. So these are four pilot models. Four pilot interventions. Eventually, we'll have more than 40 of these cost-effectiveness evaluations to compare. This was originally funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We've worked to adapt the Australian ACE assessing cost-effectiveness methodology developed by ACE Prevention and ACE Obesity. And this is continued with funding from the JPB Foundation. And it's a project we now call CHOICES, Childhood Obesity Cost-Effectiveness Study. And that's our logo. We have a great team for this pilot and for the CHOICES project. There's myself, Angie Craddock, who's a co-PI on the CHOICES project, Katie Giles, who's our project manager, Milt Weinstein, Stephen Resch, Zach Ward, our presenters you're going to hear about today. Claire Wong heads the modeling group at Columbia, our colleagues at Deakin University in Australia, and then at Queensland University. This has been a real huge team effort that spans around the globe, and it's taken us a while to do it, so we hope you like it. We've tried to develop a series of methods that we can use across all of these interventions, so we're really comparing them on what we consider to be kind of a level playing field. Recruitment of a stakeholder group, the selection of the interventions, how we specify the intervention, which is kind of a big deal, for the logic model of that and how it's implemented and costed. We do an intervention effects evidence synthesis, and then we model both short and long-term cost effectiveness, do uncertainty and sensitivity analyses, and at the same time really try and think carefully about implementation and equity considerations. So that's the overall methodology. I won't go into all the details, but you could ask a lot of questions later. Our recruitment of our stakeholder group has been really critical here. I won't give you all their names, but it's a great group. They've helped us select the interventions, the programmatic experts, nutrition, physical activity experts, policymakers. They've provided advice on specifying the intervention, what's realistic, data sources, implementation. We selected these first four interventions to be interesting. with stakeholder input. We wanted both nutrition and physical activity interventions, both policy and programmatic interventions, interventions that could be clearly specified and can be spread throughout the U.S., and you'll hear a lot more about these later. This is our rough logic model. There's an intervention that has to be implemented. We implement it nationwide. We're looking for effects on BMI and obesity in the short run, and then the long run, disability-adjusted life years, quality-adjusted life years, healthcare costs averted. That's the simple model. What makes this a bit complicated when you're talking about childhood obesity is that the cost of the interventions typically happen right when you start the interventions. And unfortunately, a lot of the long-term health outcomes in terms of incidence of disease because of overweight and obesity or the healthcare costs associated with those tend to not occur for a long time, 30, 40 years later. So that's why we focused in a lot of this analysis on shorter-term outcomes, changes in BMI and obesity, the cost per BMI as a short-term outcome, as opposed to only focusing on long-term outcomes, although we focus on that also. We developed a computer simulation model. We adapted the model that the folks in ACE in Queensland had developed, which is an Excel-based model. It's kind of complicated. We then replicated all that in a compiled programming language to make sure it worked, and that took us another year or so, and it works well. We use at risk, and we do a lot of iterations and uncertainty analyses. And we also look at different scenarios. When we think about implementation and equity considerations, we're also interested in the level of evidence that we have for the intervention effects, potential effects on equity and impact on disparities, and you'll hear our panelists talk about that, acceptability of the intervention, feasibility, sustainability, side effects, and potential impact on social and policy norms. So this is kind of the background. Now we're ready to start our the discussion of the four individual interventions. And I really think that the four people here represent, I mean, some of the really young stars doing research in this area, and so I hope you enjoy the presentations. First, Michael Long, he's a postdoc at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Good morning. So today I'll be presenting the result of our analysis on the cost-effectiveness of a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax in the United States. And I have no conflicts to disclose, and the funding is consistent with what Steve just presented. And I do want to recognize the number of co-authors who are here today and the folks at Deakin in Australia and at Columbia. But this has been a long work and a lot of contributions from the whole group. So why are we talking about sugar-sweetened beverages and a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax? Well, in the dietary guidelines in 2010, and for those of you who follow the dietary guideline process, I think this was a pretty substantial change where for the first time they recommended that Americans should reduce consumption of soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages. And so this is our national guidance on what we should be doing individually. And why are they concerned about sugar-sweetened beverages? Well, here you have intake from the 2003 to 2006 National Health and Nutrition Examination survey by age and sex. And you see high consumption, up to about 400 calories per day on average among young men, so adolescents and young men. So this is a big target for behavior change, and that's why we're talking about it. So in 2009, the Institute of Medicine actually recommended that government should implement a tax strategy to discourage consumption of foods and beverages that have minimal nutritional value, such as sugar-sweetened beverages. And last year, in 2012, APHA released a policy statement that called on local, state, and federal governments to impose excise taxes on all sugar-sweetened beverages, and, importantly, to dedicate the funds generated to obesity prevention efforts, and that's something that we'll focus on today. So in 2012, 8 states and 2 cities considered legislation in the United States to increase sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, although none passed. And for this project, we'll be modeling an excise tax of 1 cent per ounce of sugar-sweetened beverages applied nationally and administered at the state level. So Steve discussed this briefly, but just to go over the modeling framework again, this is a simulation model based on the 2005 U.S. population. And what we're really looking at is first short-term effects of a sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax on BMI compared to the natural history and what we'd expect in the U.S. population. And then in the longer term, reductions in 9 BMI-mediated diseases. And from there, disability-adjusted life years averted and healthcare cost savings. And we discount the health effects and all of our costs at 3.5% annually. So because no state or city has imposed a large excise tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, we really need to create a logic model that then we can fill with strong evidence across the logic model. So we start with an excise tax and what that would do to the change in sugar-sweetened beverage price. And I'll walk through each step of this logic model after I go through it. So then from the change in price, we can estimate the change in consumption we'd expect from a given price change. And from there, then the change in BMI. And then finally, based on changes in model BMI to disability-adjusted life years. So the first step here is, well, if there was an excise tax of 1 cent per ounce, what would that do to prices? And there is some empirical evidence and also some assumptions that we make to argue that the tax would be passed on fully to consumers. It's possible, actually, that the tax would be passed on even greater than 1 cent per ounce, but we work on the assumption that the full incidence of the tax is passed on to consumers. So based on average retail prices reported by the American Beverage Association, we estimate that the price would increase by 21%. So then, well, if we have a 21% price increase, how do we get to a change in consumption? And so there's a long history in economics of estimating changes in consumption and purchases from changes in prices. And there's actually a review published of this relationship specifically to sugar-sweetened beverages by Powell et al., where they looked at 12 estimates and found an average own price elasticity, or the change in purchase from the change in price, and a mean of negative 1.21. So what this means is that we expect a 21% price increase to result in a 26% decrease in SSB purchases. And then we have to make another assumption that the reduction in purchases is equivalent to the reduction in consumption, so that people aren't changing how much they're wasting when they reduce consumption. So that's another assumption here. But we're very confident that the price-induced change in purchases is well described, and we have a good range of uncertainty around that. But we're pretty confident that when you raise the price of sugar-sweetened beverages, people will buy less of it. So this piece of the logic model is very strong, I think. So then you go from a change in sugar-sweetened beverage consumption to a change in BMI. And here I think you get a lot of argument. And I think one of the strengths of the Choices Project overall is our focus on getting best evidence and strong causal inference on these relationships between behavior and short-term changes in BMI. And so for the case of sugar-sweetened beverages in youth, we looked at all the published systematic reviews and meta-analyses and identified one double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial that's 18 months of duration, where they gave youth either 8 ounces of sugar-sweetened beverages or 8 ounces of diet beverages that were blinded, and they found that after that 18-month period that there was an average difference-in-difference reduction of 1 kilogram for every 8-ounce serving. So this is really the engine of this model, is we say if you drink 8 ounces fewer per day as a child, your weight is expected to go down by 1 kilogram. In adults, we look at 4 studies that are longitudinal change and change studies ranging from 18 months to 4 years. And here, a 1 serving per day reduction was associated on average with a 0.39 BMI unit change. So this is really what's underlying the whole model. And I think we have pretty good evidence in youth. I mean, the gold standard evidence. There are other studies that are consistent with that finding, but we feel that the randomized controlled trial, this double blind, really captures this issue of compensation. So one could argue that, well, if you reduce sugar-sweetened beverage intake, you're just going to increase intake of other foods and beverages. And that is true. In fact, about 80% of the effect that we'd expect in youth didn't occur in the study. So there is some compensation. But in fact, when observationally and in a trial, we do see that when you either increase or reduce sugar-sweetened beverage intake, your weight does change. And finally, from there, we model longer-term shifts in disability-adjusted life years. So we assume that the effect of the tax on BMI is maintained over time. And across the long term, this would lead to reductions in BMI-related diseases. And here are the diseases that we modeled. There are others, but for now, we're using these diseases. And we then estimate disability-adjusted life years averted due to lower incidence and prevalence of disease, and then get data on costs from the Medical Expenditure Panel survey to estimate shifts in healthcare costs. So then another thing that makes this study unique is that this is the first time we've estimated the cost of administering a sugar-sweetened beverage tax, and that's part of the cost-effectiveness analysis is capturing the cost. So we called two states that at the time were administering an excise tax, and we got their annual cost of administering the tax at the state level. So then we estimate that on a per capita basis and then expand that nationally. So we then say, well, if the longest studies that we have to show the change in BMI are 4 years, let's say that the tax needs to run for 4 years to reach full effect. So we estimate the annual cost of $38.6 million nationally to administer the tax, and this includes equivalent cost from industry. So we say if government has a dollar of cost, then industry has a dollar of cost. So we're trying to argue that we've captured industry cost of complying with the tax. So over 4 years, this administration of the tax would cost $147 million. What we found was that the intervention would be national. At the time, that was 287 million children and adults, and the shifts expected from a reduction in consumption would lead to, on average, 0.1 BMI unit reduction per person. So based on the cost that we have, that would be $2.64 per BMI unit reduction overall. And if we just look at the effects on youth, it would be $6.44 per BMI unit reduced. And as again I mentioned, and the APHA policy statement really focuses on this, is the revenue that this tax would generate is substantial. And we estimated $12.4 billion in 2005 dollars, or $14.6 in 2012. And that's annual revenue. And I think when you look at the scale of policy debates in the United States right now, this is at the scale of the SNAP reduction. This is a big policy and a big revenue, and so we shouldn't ignore that fact. And it's also important to note that when you look at public support for an SSB excise tax, it goes up a lot when you say we're going to earmark this for nutrition or healthcare programs. So there's a great opportunity for states, for localities, and for the federal government to say we're going to get this revenue and we're going to also improve health. And we didn't model that effect, but it can't be understated, I don't think, how important the revenue is. So then we found that if the tax were at full effect for at least 1 year, the reductions in healthcare costs and disease incidents would make the administration cost saving. And then if the tax was maintained, or if the effects were maintained indefinitely, we estimated that the tax would result in 4.49 million years of life years saved, and 5.56 million disability-adjusted life years saved, for a total reduction in healthcare cost expenditures of $47 billion, or $321 of healthcare costs saved for every dollar spent administering the tax. And I think that part of our process, one of the strengths, is that we are also looking at health equity impacts and that implementation concerns. And when you're talking about an excise tax, the concern is that it's regressive and that this is falling on lower-income citizens more heavily. And this is a real concern. However, there's empirical evidence that soda taxes demonstrate greater benefit for overweight children, for children in African-American households and low-income households. So while it's possible that there is a regressive tax at the purchaser level, the benefits really accrue to populations that are experiencing disproportionate burden of diseases related to sugar-sweetened beverages. So I think that argument is a great way to address this concern. And then on top of that benefit that could really accrue to populations that are already burdened disproportionately, it's the revenue. And if the revenue is earmarked in a progressive fashion to offset the potentially regressive effects of the tax incidence, I think you make a strong argument that we're improving health of low-income populations and we can earmark the revenue to programs that benefit these populations. So I think the health equity argument on this policy is strong. So in summary, I think that there is strong evidence that the tax would lead to a reduction in consumption and that there will be small and meaningful weight loss across the entire population. We found that the intervention remained cost-saving across a broad range of assumptions. And I would note that sugar-sweetened beverage consumption has declined somewhat since the data that we use at our 2005 base year, but the consumption is still high. So this threat to health and the potential gains from the policy are still there. So I think that this is a good case for a policy to make on obesity prevention. So thank you.
I'm going to make a couple of comments to just try and compare across four different studies you just heard. Bomb through this. There we go. One thing to think about is all four of these interventions show evidence for effectiveness. But there are substantial differences in terms of the reach, the total cost of the intervention, the per-person BMI change, the short-term cost effectiveness. I know it's not one number, they can just, but it's a little more complicated, but interesting. So if we look at these four interventions, and you've just heard, I mean, the reach does vary substantially. The sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax hits the whole population, so you have 287 million there. The early child care, well, it's just young kids in child care, so it's a much smaller reach. But this is one metric to consider. Another metric is the just total cost of the intervention, which is in some ways related to the reach, but it's also related to the intervention. So the TV advertising is definitely the least expensive. Per person BMI unit reductions do vary substantially. You know, the early care policy didn't have as big a reach, but it has a pretty big per person BMI unit reduction. And then finally, to think about the cost per unit BMI reduction, you see this wide variability. Again, I mean, Kendrin's there wins with, 10 cents per BMI unit. Who wouldn't take that, right? In fact, how many of you would pay $191 to get a one unit by BMI unit reduction? It's kind of interesting. In contrast, it's interesting to think of what we're already paying for BMI unit reductions. Devine has a nice analysis of the high five intervention, not published yet, cost effectiveness analysis. It's a primary care intervention for overweight kids, and there it costs about $1,000 per BMI unit change. We've done a rough calculation, we'll have a better one later, of the cost per BMI unit change for bariatric surgery. Now, this is something that insurance companies pay for all over the United States, $3,000 per BMI unit change. So our society, I guess, is willing to pay this right now. Gee, Kendrin's is about 30,000 times more cost-effective. Well, that's a really crude number. But it gets you thinking about what we're willing to pay for, what we might be paying for, and why are we spending so much money on the treatment side and not as much on the prevention side here. In terms of long-term cost effectiveness, clear cost savings for the sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax occurs within the first few years, and this is the advantage of an intervention or policy change that hits the whole population, including the adult population, that are starting to experience all the diseases related to BMI and overweight right away. The childhood interventions do require long-term maintenance. Getting rid of the tax break would have to be maintained for 20 years. You could probably see how that could be maintained if you got rid of that tax break for 20 years. It's tougher to think of how the early child care intervention effect could be maintained for 35 years, unless you have policy change through all the school years, for example. And then we had the additional benefits, the sugar-sweetened beverage excise tax. Bill Dietz was asking, how long would it take for this revenue to pay for the intervention? The answer is 3 days. The TV advertising change, how long would it take to pay for that? It would actually be 1 day. So the revenue can make a difference, and this is a topic that policymakers have to be interested in. So now let's hear some commentary from Claire Wong, and then after that, Bill Dietz. So, Claire, do you want to start?
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Claire Wong. I am a faculty at Columbia University in the Department of Health Policy and Management. My training was in decision sciences. I started in the clinical field and then get trained in decision sciences. So in the past 10 years, the involvement with C4 Makers Group and really put this into context and seeing this being presented today is really like my dream come true. So my commentary, I just wanted to take a couple minutes putting the context of the four pilot results that you hear about today into the broader context of cost effectiveness as a discipline. So when I started thinking about what is good value, I just wanted to highlight. So I did a quick search in the Tufts University cost effectiveness analysis database. So there were 30 studies came up in terms of obesity and the cost effectiveness of them. 28 of them are related to pharmaceutical and surgical solutions to obesity reduction. So this is really one of the few studies that you hear about it today to think about prevention and prevention at the community and population level. Just with this very quick table, I'm highlighting the three studies that has been done in the past in terms of childhood obesity prevention. So for example, CATCH has been shown to cost $900 per quality gain, quality adjusted life year gained. This is a very commonly used ratio called the incremental cost effectiveness ratio to represent the value of investing in this program. Very cost effective. Planet Health, this was a study done by Lian Wang at CDC in 2003, showing that Planet Health, which is a comprehensive intervention in middle schools to reduce obesity, is effective in females, but not so effective for boys, at a price tag of $4,305 per quality gained. On the other hand, something that feels really nice, moving school bus or walking school bus, is to have adults walk with children on safe routes to school. It's not effective, and it was being published by our colleagues at Deakin University. Other interventions, as I show here, including the orlistat, that's the anti-obesity drug, the gastric bypass surgery, with a price tag of $10,000 to $35,000 for reducing adult obesity, and social support for promoting working and so on and so forth. How do you think about these numbers? So of course, if an intervention is cost-saving, which means you walk into a supermarket, you walk out with cash, that's the best scenario in the whole world, but that doesn't happen very often. In the healthcare world, some of the childhood vaccination programs will actually achieve that cost-saving status, but for most cases, we're looking for a good deal. You walk into a supermarket, you're looking for a good deal. So these childhood obesity prevention programs listed here, as well as what you hear about today, they're great deals. Just to give you a little bit more perspective, in terms of HIV counseling and screening for high-risk population is valued at $44,000 per quality gained. For diabetes, self-monitoring and control is within the range of what we're seeing today. And we're promoting very heavily for better diabetes control. That's valued at $4,000 per quality gained. So here are in a way, you can see the value of investing in childhood obesity prevention programs. Just to put a little bit more context, obese adults on average spend close to $2,000 more on healthcare each year. And that is sort of the obvious benefit of reducing obesity in childhood as well as in adulthood. But that by itself is not the reason we're doing this. We're reducing childhood obesity not because we wanted to save money only in the long run. We wanted to buy health. We wanted to buy more health health-adjusted life years or quality-adjusted life years, or to reduce disability-adjusted life years. So another colleague of ours, Leo Transand and at NYU, actually take one step further and ask the question, as a society, how much do we want it to spend to invest in childhood obesity prevention in order to be cost-effective? He found that to reduce 1 percentage point of obesity in 12-year-olds, we should be willing to spend $2.03 billion as a society, accounting for the fact that they're reducing their reductions in healthcare costs in the future, as well as the value that as a society we put on buying additional health for years. So why do we still need choices? When I started thinking about the cost effectiveness of investing in childhood obesity prevention policies, the first challenge was, well, it's too challenging. It is too hard. But then just because the question is hard doesn't mean that it should not be answered. In fact, it should be the other way around. So a lot of the decision-making is in the absence of definite trial data, clinical trial data in this field. And in fact, I think this is where model-based, simulation-based cost-effectiveness analysis can make the largest contribution, because otherwise it is really difficult to expect or to conduct a large-scale, long-term clinical trial to look at, for example, changing a tax code for advertising. So I really think that the strength of the Choices Project lies in the systematic integration of evidence synthesis, as you've seen today, and combine that into a logical model where not only the logical pathway, you can question and discuss whether or not each pathway is based on the best evidence, but in fact you can challenge the parameter inputs, every single parameter that we use in the model. You can say, well, why don't you use the lower bound of the confidence interval? And we will say, sure, let me run the model for you and see how that turns out. And I think that conversation is very, very positive in terms of facilitating a dialogue going forward and making a difference. And obviously the cost is the elephant in the room, because we all wanted to know how much things cost and how much revenue we can generate. Finally, I also wanted to applaud our stakeholders that really gave us a lot of perspectives, so that the interventions that you hear about today and also in the future will not be hypothetical. We'll try to be as realistic as possible. For example, the PE policy, we were based on Texas and Oklahoma, and what are the bills being proposed in Connecticut and so on. So I think that is really, we wanted to be grounded in what is happening in the political discussions. And we're engaging the stakeholders from the start, instead of in a traditional format. We researchers build the model, spit out the results, and send it to them and say, hey, here's a study, you should use this. So I do wanted to discuss some of the limitations and tell you very excited about our future plans. This is just the four studies that you hear about today. It's our pilot. We're expecting to expand from there to address 40 more studies, 40 more interventions with the same spirit and realistic groundings. So, but I do wanted to point out, we realize that the long-term perspective is much needed in the discussion of childhood obesity prevention or all child health in general. We realize that there's a lack of long-term maintenance data, that a lot of the times we rely on assumptions. Our attempt is to use the best evidence available, use the longest studies we can find. However, we still need to make assumptions on how these interventions will maintain, the intervention effects will maintain into adulthood and beyond. So our strategy is we have to leverage the cohort study as much as we can, sometimes to piece together multiple cohort studies in order to understand what is the long-term behavioral change that is possible. And the other discussion is on discounting. For those who are economists, the common practice is to discount future health benefits and cost. And that inherently, so currently we're using 3.5% a year discount rate, or 3%. That is consistent with the US and the UK practices. However, the most recent World Health Organization GBD study recommended no discounting, which means a lot of the health programs that would have a longer time frame, such as prevention of certain diseases, early prevention of diseases, we have to wait decades in order to harvest the benefit. We'll now have a chance to compete with something that is more immediate. So I think that's an ongoing discussion on the methodological front. And finally, I wanted to sort of preview that we were transitioning into an even better model than what you hear about today, to be able to better replicate state-specific populations using micro-simulation. So simulation one individual at a time and simulate many, many of them. So in that case, we'll be able to capture the entire distribution, especially focusing on the tail of the distribution, such as the most obese or the most poor. So stay tuned for more studies from the group. And again, many thanks for our stakeholders and our colleagues here.
So Claire gave you the broader context of cost-effectiveness studies, and I'd like to even broaden that further by putting this current series of studies in the very broad context of the response to the obesity epidemic. I believe that really began with the publication of the CDC maps, which was phase one, enhancing the visibility. That occurred in about 1999, followed at CDC by our mandate to develop strategies and targets for the obesity epidemic. And early on, we had no idea of really where we would have the biggest impact. So we started with breastfeeding, physical activity, fruit and vegetable intake, and television viewing. There was not a substantial evidence base around any of these issues, particularly on the intervention side, although an early milestone was the Guide for Clinical Preventive Services, which made a variety of recommendations about strategies that could increase physical activity. Interestingly enough, that Guide on Clinical Preventive Services also focused on policy changes, environmental changes that would lead to these shifts in physical activity, which was the first establishment of the principle that we ought to be focusing on policy, environmental, and systems changes. In about the 2004-2005, there began a much broader mobilization around obesity. That was when our program funding for states began, community-level interventions began, and new investments occurred as a result of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's commitment to reduce obesity by 2015, and particularly important was Kaiser Permanente's engagement in this field, which began even earlier than the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Those philanthropic investments were matched by a growing budget for the division that I used to head at CDC for investment in state programs around obesity prevention and control. About that same time, we began to shift from these kind of broad targets, breastfeeding, physical activity, television viewing, fruit and vegetable intake, to setting specific applications, beginning with schools, because CDC had a very strong role in school health, but expanding rapidly to work sites, communities, early care and education, and most recently medical settings. And it's clear the First Lady's initiative in this area was extraordinarily important, not only to heighten the visibility, but to tighten the focus on setting specific interventions. Let's move child care challenge, the Let's Move Salad Bars to Schools, the Drink Up initiative, the healthy communities and state and local programs. But it wasn't until really the last several years that very substantial efforts began to build the evidence base. And Steve's group deserves a lot of credit for that. It began to move from observational data to randomized clinical trials. That Claire's work on and Steve's on establishing sugar drinks as an important target and demonstrating the increased intake that was associated with sugar drink, the increased caloric intake associated with sugar drinks was an early step forward in identifying this as an important target. And then Claire's work on identifying the calorie gap associated or needed to reverse obesity and return BMI, the mean BMI level to where it was in the 1970s, began to offer us a gauge by which we could judge specific interventions against how they met that calorie gap. And that was tightened even further by the use of calorie costs to prioritize policies based on Claire's article this year in Preventive Medicine. So these studies in that context take us even further down the line towards beginning to use a strong science to prioritize policies, to think logically about what is likely to have the biggest impact, not only in terms of weight reduction, but also in terms of cost effectiveness. But as Michael alluded to, implementation is still a challenge. I think that's the era that we are in now, where the feasibility of these interventions is a critical challenge. We're beginning to move from what to do to how it can be achieved. And I think we have some early indications of success by the declines that we're seeing around the country in both communities and states with respect to pediatric obesity. But I think we have to recognize, as has been alluded to in some of these presentations, the political climate and a resource-constrained environment. And it's quite clear that the budget arguments that are going on now really turn on two issues. One is that the role of increasing healthcare costs in driving the federal budget, and secondly, the need for increased revenue sources. And these presentations, particularly the soda tax and the removal of the advertising exemptions, can work on both sides of that budget in terms of cost savings from healthcare costs as well as revenue generation. And we need to think and argue in terms of the co-benefits of those initiatives. Michael mentioned SNAP and the offsets that this $12.4 or $14.6 billion a year in 2012 numbers would bring in terms of annual revenue. Another argument that is on the horizon is that the CHIP benefits, child insurance programs, are going to end in 2015. They're going to come up for renewal. That costs $90 billion over a 10-year period. And with the current budget climate, that needs to be offset by cost savings elsewhere. We have a perfect revenue-generating source in terms of the sugar drink tax, which would more than pay for the CHIP program going forward. So I think that these presentations did a terrific job of highlighting the cost benefits of these initiatives. Setting specific, critically important. But now the challenge remains to develop the political will and the political arguments necessary to implement them. Thanks for those presentations.
Thank you, Claire, and thank you, Bill. Well, now I hope folks in the audience have some questions. I mean, otherwise we've got a lot of dead time here. Would you like to come up and just jog up? Sure, why not? And burn a couple of calories.
Hi, my name is Allison. This is primarily for Dr. Long. I'm aware that there are some studies in tobacco that show that there are different price elasticities around tobacco for different population groups, particularly around age and around race ethnicity. And this is a particular interest of mine, and it's sugar sweet beverages. And I have never come across a similar study for the price elasticity of sugar sweet beverages. So I'm wondering if you know of anything that's out there around this, and your thoughts on it, and what it might mean if there are different price elasticities for these groups, particularly youth, what it might mean for your overall analysis.
What we tried to do was capture the range of price elasticity effects of the zone.
Yeah.
And so we were looking at the average effect. Really, there are a few reports, one by folks at the USDA, Lynn and all, and Kevin Hall's group is involved with that, that estimate different demand systems by household income level, and they find some different effects there. But when we reviewed the literature, Andreeva et al. And myself and Kelly Ronell looked at the price elasticity literature on food, we didn't see a consistent picture there. One thing to note about sugar sweetened beverage expenditures is that they're such a small part of the overall household budget that you don't see big income effects on income elasticity. So really, it's a direct price effect that we're talking about. And it depends on the household share, so households that buy more of it may not be as elastic as people that are sort of one-off buying sugar sweetened beverages and don't really feel attached to buying it all the time. Then a side note, I guess, on excise taxes versus sales taxes, and this is really where you could see differential effects by income. So if you're a low-income household and you're buying sugar sweetened beverages at Walmart for 1 cent per ounce, often that's the price. This is a 100% increase in the price of your sugar sweetened beverage intake, and that would be a much bigger effect for a household that's already purchasing off-brand high-volume sugar sweetened beverages versus someone who's looking at buying single-serve convenience sugar sweetened beverages. This is a smaller price effect. So we could see much bigger effects in lower-income households that have already been relying on off-brand high-volume purchases.
Question, Jerry.
I'm Jerry Hinchy from the Food Research and Action Center. First, before I ask my question, I really want to compliment you on this excellent research. I think it's going to be helpful in the political realm. So my question is, if people do, because everyone in my row was like, wow, and they were writing it down. So if people do want to use this politically, what's the best way for them to get the information and talk to you about it?
We have handouts at the back that have all this stuff written down with the corrected abstracts. We'll also post them on our website at the PRC, and I think they're also available as handouts from the meeting if you go to the APHA website and sign in. We can get that. Yes. By the way, Jerry's one of our stakeholders. Prabhu?
So, hi, my name is Prabhu. Is the data and the modeling robust enough that you could turn the clock back and tell me what I could have done 30 years ago for us not to be here today?
I'll let, who wants to answer that one?
I'll say a little bit about that. I think theoretically we could do that if all the data is there, and certainly NHANES has been going on for 30 years. But it was really challenging even to get, for PE especially, estimates of what's happening currently, how much PE is provided, where they're providing it. I have no idea if we could even find that information 30 years ago. We could probably talk to everybody in the audience, and they have a number. but that would be really challenging.
Yes.
Hi. Bernice. Hi, my name is Bernice. The presentations were really impressive. My question is predominantly for Jessica or Debbie, related to the school or early child care setting. I'm wondering, is a way to increase the political will from schools, if you could consider, if it's potentially quantifiable, the cost of effectiveness on school-related outcomes related to academic success and academic achievement, given the relationship between physical activity and school performance?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I said in my presentation, I mean, those are definitely big impacts that would happen by increasing physical activity in schools. It's something that I think we could explore. We're willing to think about it. We definitely will be modeling impacts on health outcomes directly related to physical activity, and we'll be considering, and we'll certainly discuss the whole way through, impacts on school behavior and cognition and classroom atmosphere. If anyone is an expert in that area and is willing to help us find data sources for that, certainly that would be great.
I think the other thing that Jessica mentioned and that Claire mentioned is that, cost effectiveness is not just, there's not a rule that says if you're at this level, you're cost effective. You have to figure out what people are willing to pay for those improvements in behavior and things like that in schools. And so we can evaluate it. We can't really judge the cost effectiveness without having some numbers about those thresholds.
Good point, Devine. Yes. Yes, please come up to the mic.
Hi, Mara Sash, Change Lab Solutions. One, I just want to give a plug that we have lots of model policies on our website, sugar sweetened beverages, and probably some of the other 40 that you're looking at. But I want to put out a couple of challenges from a legal point of view. One is, if we do move particularly to federal level taxing on sugar sweetened beverages, to make sure, we have to be sure that we're not preempting state or local action on the same issue, because states and localities, I can see what happened in menu labeling, where we had all the state and local activity, all sorts of earned media, lots of public education, boom, we got federal preemption, that went away. And we lost so much momentum in raising awareness that I would really want to be sure that the advocacy movement at the federal level works hard against preempting, which would mean disallowing states or localities from doing the tax strategies themselves to
pay for park and rec programs, to pay for PE at the school level. It's just really important that we keep our eyes wide open to that.
Hey, do you want to comment on that one, Michael, before you go to the next one?
Well, I think what you're seeing is similar to many labeling, that the movement is really at the local and state level. So I don't expect that you will see a federal excise tax on sugar sweetened beverages before you see a substantial tax at the city or state level. But I think it's also less likely that you'll see preemption on taxation, which historically has some rights on that end at the state and local level as well. But I would predict that you'll see local action before you see federal action.
Yeah, we talked about maybe paying for children's health, and maybe that helps the state level too, but I just worry about it. Then the other issue is around the tax subsidies for advertising. Be a huge First Amendment challenge to just allow, take away subsidies for certain types of advertising without taking subsidies away for all advertising. I just want to put that out there so that we don't say, oh, let's go put a lot of weight behind that, because it'd be enormously challenging legally to do just certain types of speech, not all speech at once. So just throw that out there.
I think it's a good point. Go ahead, Kendra.
That's exactly right. We first considered the policy options we had for limiting advertising to children. Our stakeholders felt very strongly that actually creating limitations on food companies for what they could advertise was impossible in the current political and legislative climate. And our stakeholders felt more sure that tax code was a safer or sort of more feasible option. I know still with substantial hurdles, but it's a point well taken.
Yeah, I think both Samantha Graff and Jennifer Pomerantz have given us some advice here, but I think it's still something that has to be tried. Yes, in the back. Here's a chance to jog up and burn a calorie or two.
So thanks. Really good work today. Just two questions. Maybe just commentary on the general state of research. There were some very key assumptions that look like we're, 15 years old. So maybe just commentary. What do you think, I guess if you had a wish list, what sort of research direction would you like to see to help further this sort of work? My second question is, have you, maybe just a suggestion for future research, have you considered doing cost-effective analysis on the impact of farm subsidies? Because in terms of the sugar-sweetened beverage issue at the national level, that's probably going to be, I'm going to guess it's probably very competitive to the federal excise tax. So, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I guess I'll throw out one wish list I have, is that for all the folks that do effectiveness studies, and that's a lot of the world of public health and public health research, start collecting some cost data, please. It's easier than measuring effectiveness. I also wish that schools of public health would start teaching students that it's really important to consider cost because it's not part of the required curriculum. Just a thought. Any others?
Certainly in the physical activity world, it would be great if more people were using objective measures of physical activity, like pedometers and accelerometers. And if that could happen on a national level, that would be amazing.
I think one thing that we thought about is I'm working at the University of Washington now, one of my colleagues, who's just Canada, is doing a lot of work on child care centers. We have no idea how much it will actually cost centers to implement these changes in terms of, we can tell them you should increase physical activity, but we didn't necessarily model how they should do that. Should they use structured physical activity? Should they be buying some kits who are using not DVDs, who are supposed to reduce screen time, but things like that. And so one thing that we're working on, and I would love for people to work on, is evaluating how much institutions spend on improving these behaviors and how we
solve them. On the farm subsidy point, I think it's something that we can definitely look at. I probably defer to Barry Popkin and his group on that long run effect. And when I think about farm subsidies, I think about six decades of investment, and I don't know that it's going to be easy to reverse our current farm structure by just a shift in that subsidy amount.
But maybe we can think about that. So to, yes, question. Lee.
Hi there. I'm Leland Ackerson from UMass Lowell. And I first want to say this was terrific. I really appreciated the presentations. It was great. My question, I'm acknowledging this may be beyond the scope of what the study was, but have you thought about, or do you think it's possible to acknowledge some perhaps unintended consequences of these projects? For example, if Coca-Cola lost profits, I wouldn't cry too much, but I wouldn't feel bad if, I mean, there are people who will lose jobs for that, things like that, or small businesses that might go out of business if they can't, you know, make enough sales, that kind of thing. So I thought about that, and I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the political world, like the Coca-Cola or their political action groups will use this idea of, you know, jobs, or that kind of thing as a hammer against these policies.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I was going to ask Lisa Powell to respond to that. She's a nice study on that topic.
Well, I actually just finished a study that looked at the employment effects of a sugar-sweetened beverage tax coming out in the speech. So yes, the beverage industry has spent a lot of money to convince us that we should be very worried that jobs will be lost. And their estimates, though, are based on the fact that people will drink less sugar-sweetened beverages.
And that is true.
Sales will go down. However, they don't account for the fact that people will substitute towards other things. So if you don't spend a dollar on A, you'll spend a dollar on B, or you might save that money and it will go into investment. They also don't model the fact that tax revenue will be taken in, and then governments will spend that money, and that also creates jobs. So actually what we found is there's essentially a zero net effect. So there will be some lower kind of number of jobs in the beverage industry, but those are actually completely offset by increased jobs in the private sector and the public sector. So you can think about it, truck drivers who were previously driving trucks that held SSBs, now they'll be driving trucks that hold other goods. So that's coming out in a couple of months, so I'll be interested to hear what the beverage industry has to say in response to that.
So great. I mean, on that really upbeat, positive note, why don't we have a final round of applause for our four panelists.